Well, it's been nice being here. This is only the second year in my ministry that I've been able to do anything like this. I've worked with young people before and directed bike camps and canoe camps and counselor training, but this is only the second year in my whole ministry that I've ever spoken at family camps, and it's been right here. And I'm thankful to the Lord for the opportunity and your kindness, listening, and the care you give. I've also enjoyed meeting so many people and ministering the word to them. And I've enjoyed listening to Dave McLeod. I'd like to just say a few things. I think in our assemblies, we need to involve ourselves in premarital counseling, biblical premarital counseling. We really need to be involved in using these principles and teaching people right after I get home. I'm going to start with an unsaved couple. Now, I may kind of shock you. All the unsaved people, we make a deal. Okay, we'll make some deals. I won't do a saved person, an unsaved person, but I'll do unsaved people. And the deal is they have to do what I tell them to do. They have to do their assignments. They have to read the scriptures. They have to come back ready. And that any time I want, I can quit. I can back up. So I reserve the right. They must do everything I ask. And we study the scriptures. It's really a unique opportunity because many of these people haven't darkened the door of a church, and all of a sudden, as Dave said, they want God bless them. I always ask them, why don't you go to, same thing as Dave, why don't you go to Justice and Peace? Why don't you go there? Well, okay, church wedding. And the other thing is, they have to come. During the time of the counseling, they have to come to the family Bible. And if they can't agree to that, it's finished. But we've had some unique opportunities. So I'll take two unsaved people, and I don't take a lot of them. I don't take a lot of them at all, but it's really a good way. And with our Christian kids to teach them. But it's a good way when some people who've never darkened the door of a chapel or a church call you up and they want something. At least sit down and have one interview with them and probe and pick and get in there and find out what they're thinking. It's really a good opportunity to do things for Jesus Christ. And it's been something that we've begun to use slowly and effectively at Wauwatosa Chapel. So two unsaved people, very good thing to do. And the thing that David McLeod is teaching are very vital. Also the things last night about, I'm into this a little bit. I'd recommend a book called Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. A unique book put out by a group that I signed called the Danvers Statement. I don't know if I'm picking away some Dave's going to say the name, but a book that is worth reading and buying. Very, very good biblical studies on all of these themes. Particularly, great amount of study done on headship and submission and the wrong use of words and the wrong definitions of words. And it is a good book to read. Now I'll go to my thing, James chapter 4. In chapter 4, verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city. Spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. Whereas you don't know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. And now you're boasting your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. Family Bible Hour is over. There's coffee and donuts downstairs. And the brethren are downstairs and they have a map on the table. And James gets his cup of coffee and he's standing behind, sipping his coffee, listening to all of these. And his brother spread this map on the table and this guy says, you know, the empire is spreading. They're building new cities. They're asking citizens to people these cities. And guys, we can get in on the ground floor and we can make a killing. I say, boy, you get that franchise. And I'm telling you guys, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. And James is standing there sipping his coffee, listening to these guys with this map of the Roman world spread on the table. And James says, come on, he says. Come on now, he says. He says, you have a wrong attitude about this. Let's look at a few things. Very quickly, I really want to get into the end of chapter 5. So the first, last part of 4 and the first part of 5, I'm going to run through very quickly. But James looked at it, and the problem, of course, is these people were making plans, and planning's wrong, obviously. It's the false confidence that's wrong. These men planned as if God wasn't in it. They were making these plans, and it was like, well, sure, well, we're going, and a year from now we'll come back, and we'll make a killing, and we'll retire, we'll have a big profit, and everything's going to be all right. And James says, you forgot one thing in this whole situation. You've left the Lord out. You forgot one thing in this whole situation. You said, if the Lord wills. You've forgotten how brief life is. So, planning isn't wrong. It was the confidence in their success and the way that got out of this thing that was wrong. They were just leaving God out of it. And there's a lot of unknown in life, isn't there? There's a lot of mysteries. There's a lot of unknown that you and I can figure out. There's much of the will of God that is beyond our control. And we're up to plan. And our plans often fall through. And we placed a lot of hope in those plans. We placed a lot of stock in those plans. Much of our happiness lies in the promises we make to ourselves for the time ahead. And it doesn't arrive. And we fix a definite time. And we plan ahead and fix a definite time. And we're pretty sure about the plan, but we don't take any thought for God into it. And that's all James is saying. These men were living, and they obviously were thinking of their own profit, and they were not thinking about God and what it could do. And a Christian has to be able to think clearly about some of the things. So these people formed their plans as if they knew and could control their lives. We'll just go do this and this and this, and this will be the result, and we will live happily ever after. So they're making plan for a whole year, and James says, making plans for a whole year, don't you realize that life is so short, it's like a vapor. Think of the parable in Luke chapter 12, verses 16 to 21. This farmer who planted and had a bumper crop. I don't think God condemned him for working hard. The early rain came, the latter rain came, he had bumper crop, and God didn't condemn him for working hard at all, the Lord did. But he got this big crop, and he said, wow, this is great, man. So I think I'll build these barns or these silos. I'll put it in there. I'll have enough for the future. I won't go hungry. And if there's a famine in the land, people will always come and they'll buy from me because I'll have something to sell. And so he was just thinking, now I'm in control. I have control of my life. And that night when he went to bed, he had a heart attack, remember? Well, I do, yeah. Lord, just come on home tonight. Take your soul tonight. And so this is what James is talking about. The uncertainty of life. It ought not be a reason for fear or for inaction, but it certainly should be a chance to depend on God. And there's a lot of mysteries in life, a lot of strange things that take place in our lives, a lot of things that we plan for and don't work out. So we are to consider God. So James sees this, and he just sees this flippant, careless, sure attitude. And he said, don't you people understand that we don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow? You're making plans for a year, and you've got it all laid out, and you don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. You don't even know what will happen. A friend of ours in Milwaukee, who's now part of a new assembly in Oconomowoc, has a 27-year-old son, and we would call him the good son. The godly son. The son who started his own business. He's doing well. He works for somebody else, and they make him an executive, and he's doing well. And a couple weeks ago, a little pain in the side. Oh, boy. Hurt a little bit. Go to the doctor. Perhaps have an ulcer. And the doctor took some tests and said, you have a rare form of liver cancer. That's it. John Hopkins Hospital that specializes in it said, we won't take them. We work with that form, and we've got no results. We've got no place with it. So this young man has given his business away, and he's working part-time for his employer, and he's waiting to die. 27 years old, the good son. The dedicated, the graduate of Moody. And we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And so James is simply saying, bring God into it. Life is short, he said, and it deceives us. The life of promises, but it's like a vapor, just like a cloud in the midst of this cloud passing away. Like the morning cloud, Hosea said, passing away. So there's the brevity of life. And it deceives us. And it's good for us to ask some questions about our life. What do I wish to do with my life? Why do I want to make money? Why am I interested in success? Is Christ in it? And is there hope in it? The kind of hope in Jesus Christ, the kind of hope that is important. One thing that has been very good for me over the years is to visit nursing homes. You know, visiting nursing homes isn't the most pleasant thing to do. And I at first kind of rebelled against it a little bit. Something in me that rebelled against it. But because I had to do it a number of times, I decided to become at peace and think more about life and death. But the thing that made me do this about visiting a nursing home was that I was talking to people who were, maybe their minds were gone, or people who had strokes, and they needed to be helped. They needed to be hoisted in bed and taken out of bed and put to bed. They needed to have help going to the bathroom. These people were productive human beings once. Executives. Leaders. One of the men I visited was a fourth in the city of Milwaukee in charge of all the streets and alleys and production of civil servants. And the stroke brought disaster. The money started going out the window. Gradually, the money started being eaten away. Then his wife quickly, who was nursing him quickly, suddenly, died of cancer, a shock. Quickly, she was going to take care of him. And the money's going, and the money was going, and going, and going. Gone. This is how life is. And going to nursing home has been a very interesting experience for me. Seeing people, talking to them. And so James thinks about this. We don't know what a life will be. There's a lot of mysteries in life. And only God can make us prosper. And James says, you should say, if the Lord wills. Some people say that's just a cheat saying, oh, I always say, Lord willing. Well, don't misuse it. But still, we should say, if the Lord wills, for goodness sake. I've heard people say in the past, I'm tired of hearing this, if the Lord wills. Just get out and do it. Well, if the Lord wills, see, we'll get out and do it. And so James is mentioning this way. So we ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this and that. Why does James say that? Well, he wants these people to include God. He wants them to slow down on their plan. Include God, if the Lord will. To see that maybe their even ideas about making money are wrong. Maybe it's for themselves. Maybe it's for their own comfort. Maybe they haven't thought of others. And when James says, just include this statement, Lord willing, that kind of stops you short. Lord willing. What is our life? It is short. It is brief. And so James talks about this. And there's many frustrations that come in our life from not allowing God room to work. Many frustrations that come in our lives as we plan. There's much bitterness with God for not getting what we want. And that is something that often happens. And so we ought to plan in it. And as we plan, and I don't have any problem saying it's not wrong to plan. We ought to plan. We can plan. But we ought to bring God into it, Lord willing, we ought to include Him in it, and we ought to make sure that we are giving our life to Him. If He has any little twists and turns, we're so afraid of poverty in our day. We're so afraid of not having, we're not even willing to do anything where it looks like we might risk anything. How fearful we are. My years as a missionary, I couldn't minister today without them. If I would have just graduated from the school like Emmaus and went off to some local chapel, they would have eaten me up. They would have cannibalized me. Man, I would have been... But the years on the mission field were a great preparation. And when I walked back into our culture, after 14 years of bumming the boonies in the mountains and the jungles of Columbia, one of the things that shocked me is that we were the most affluent, wealthy, materialistic, security-minded people who were worried about everything. We're so worried, so incredibly worried about things that we're running scared. Is that the bottom's going to drop out tomorrow? And that kind of overwhelmed me. And after living in a culture where there was so much poverty, so James says, include the Lord's will, and if the Lord wills, we shall do this or that. Bring Him into it. Trust Him. Realize that He can change your plan. What if the Lord doesn't have that for you in your life? So this is what James talking about. They were fixing a definite date, and the future is uncertain, the presumption and attitude. What is life? It's a vapor. We're taught to keep a constant sense of dependence on the will of God. And there's evil in their present attitude, verse 16. But you now boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. There's evil. And this word boasting here is kind of an interesting word. This word boasting comes from, I believe, a Greek word that has to do with a wondering quack. This is my trusty book, and it's a wondering quack. This is the guy who's going around with his little bottle of Mother Fletcher's Elixir. Say, you buy this stuff, takes care of gallstones, grows hair on your head, see, and it makes you peppy, and it'll, boy, I tell you, just buy this stuff, it's a cure-all, say. Wondering bunch of quacks with their Mother Fletcher's Elixir. I tell you, when you roll up their sleeves, and boy, it'll do anything you want. You're boasting just like these quacks, he says, running around, boasting. Is that this is a cure-all forever, son. We should trust God. And then he says, of course, to him that knows to do sin and not does it is wrong. And he said, saying, the sin of omission. I think it refers to the will of God. If we know we are to trust the Lord this way and we don't do it, it's sin. A little sidelight I'd like to throw in here. You notice how many times James is the first book. You know how many times James says things that you've heard in other letters, other epistles? Have you noticed how many times James says things that appear other places? One commentary said there were over 23 references to the Sermon on the Mount. James lived and breathed the Scripture. But you know, when we say there is a difference between Paul and James, I like to just sometimes find out how much James influenced Paul and some of the phrases Paul might have used. I don't know, but it's quite interesting. So James says, if you know to do this, it's sin. Act on what you know and live this. And it is sin to omit trust in the Lord. If you know you should trust Him, then it is sin. Now, I have to move on, though, because I'm anxious to get to other parts. So let's go to the first part of chapter 5 here. And he gets in and he talks about the worthlessness of riches. You can see James has it on his mind. And James says nothing in verse 5, chapter 5, verse 1 to 6, about the fact of we're having to give it all away and share it. He's not a liberation theologian, nor am I. He's not condemning all riches. He's not condemning people who have it. But he's certainly condemning particular things that are characteristics of the world. All right, so in chapter 5, he talks here about the worthlessness of it. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Well, that's the Old Testament prophet. Weep and howl. What? The misery's coming upon you. Well, many years later, 10, 11, 12 years later, the city of Jerusalem would be overrun. The Roman armies would come in. Lives would be shattered. Fortunes would be lost. People would be scattered in the world. The city of Jerusalem and the nation of Israel would never be the same. Maybe James sees that. I don't know. But here he observes the rich. And he observes the rich in their use of money. He says in this portion, in verse 2, they hoard it. Your riches are corrupted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded. Your corrosion will be a witness against you. You will eat your flesh like fire. You've heaped up treasures in the last days. Verse 3, rather than verse 2, they hoarded it. But James talks here about the rich and their use of money and how they acquire it and what it does to them and the coming trouble. And perhaps these are unbelievers. Perhaps they're believers in these synagogues. The point simply is, as our Lord said, woe to you that are rich, for you have your consolation. So James sees an attitude, and this attitude is an attitude that is prevalent. Notice how the wealth is described. The wealth is described, verse 2, as clothing. And in verse 3 is hoarding of silver and gold. And in verse 4, lands, harvesting, corn. So the very same things people had in those days, they have in this day. The worry of the right kind of clothes. And hoarding, saving up for a rainy day, more or less. And hoarding it for themselves and not sharing it. And not seeing how God can use it. Or land. And notice the condition he talks about. It rots away. It corrodes and it rots away. And it will eat at your flesh like a fire. Eat at our flesh. It just rots our being. It rots our character, eating at our flesh. Kind of a, metaphorically speaking, just something that eats away at us. And it just rots and eats our lives away. So James is talking about this matter. Our Lord said in Matthew 16:19, don't lay up treasures in heaven where moth and rust can destroy and thieves steal. Now, even though gold can't be corroded, it's going to perish with this world. So James comes out as an Old Testament prophet. Your riches are corrupted. The clothing you wear are moth-eaten. And your silver and gold are corroded. Well, silver and gold, they said, they don't corrode. They don't rust. It'll disappear. It'll disappear with the whole world system. Doesn't have that much lasting value. And their corrosion will witness against you and will eat at your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasures in the last days by hoarding it up. What you've really done is heaping up judgment for yourself in the last days. So he talks to his disciples weeping and wailing, and perhaps he is referring, as I said, to what will go on in Jerusalem. And they hoard it. And you and I know the sins of the Old Testament. Achan, in Joshua 7:21, right? He saw some of these things and, wow. And he took and he dug a hole in his tent and buried it. And he was judged for it. And in 2 Kings 5:5-22, the servant of Elisha, who ran out and said, well, my master says, yeah, give me some of this. And he wanted it. And it brought judgment to him. So James talks about this. Riches can't buy love. And they can't buy respect. And they can't buy usefulness to the Lord, although we can use it that way. So James attacks these people. And he looks at their sin, right, of hoarding it up. Look at verse 4. Their sin was also oppression. And I, as I said before, I'm not a liberation theologian. I don't think all wealth is got in the backs of people. But look at what they said in verse 4. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you've kept back by fraud, cry out. And the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of the Sabbath. They paid people every day. I didn't understand this before until I lived in South America. Many people are paid every day. Many times, if you go in the entrance to Bucaramanga, it's kind of a, looks like a, they call it an expressway, but now when you look at an expressway, it's just, anyway, they call it the autopista. And at the top of the autopista is a hill. And people sit on this. And as the trucks come in from out of town, these guys jump in front of the trucks. I'll work for you. Or maybe a farmer comes in and says, I need 10 guys for today. I need 20 guys for today. I need 10 guys for a week. And he grabs these and puts them in his truck and takes them. And they get paid every day. And the money they get paid every day, they go home, and at night, and the wife goes to the market every day and buys her yuca and her platano and her potatoes and a few things, and that's it for the day. But some guys won't pay them. I've seen this happen. I don't keep the books. It's late, say. I'll take care of it. Come on. Well, these people depended upon it every day. That's what these people were doing. They were asking people to serve them, help them build their wealth, and saying, oh, it's 5 o'clock. I got to open the books. Tomorrow. I mean, I leave a lot of people in church. I've seen this in Latin America more than once. Oh, I'll get you tomorrow. I'm getting you in a couple of days. These people have worked hard. So this is one of the things he's talking about. They've hoarded it. There's this covetousness that he talks about and the hoarding it. And then there's also getting it by oppression, abusing their power. That's what one of the things wealth can do, abusing our power, making us feel independent, making us feel something we're not. They have need of the workers, but the workers needed them. And so they were paid on a daily basis. You can find this many, many places in the Old Testament. And what they were basically doing is taking advantage of people. The Christian sees people for their well-being. He has a responsibility to them. These people see people as serving them. Is that what wealth can do to us? Just see people serving us. Or are we to be servants of other people? So loyalty to Christ is loyalty to other people. In other words, there were indulgences. We know that verse 5, they lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury and have fattened their hearts as in the day of slaughter. Boy, you can find Old Testament references of that. Fattened their hearts as in the day of slaughter. Just think of old animals that come running over and overeating these bulls of Bashan, as they call them. And the indulgences. The injustice added indulgences to their life. And the word luxury here comes from a word to live in softness. It literally means to break down. Giving the idea that soft living broke down their discipline, their moral character, it broke down their spirituality. And so that's where I understand the word comes from. The soft living, in the end day, saps and destroys a man and a woman's moral fiber. It's hard to have a lot and not to indulge in it. And you and I always understand how one thing that is a luxury can become a necessity. So James attacks this idea. So it attacks what's going to happen. It's all going to perish, he says. And you've got it, and you haven't even been concerned about your people that helped you get it. And you've lived a life of pleasure and luxury. You've fattened your hearts to the day of slaughter. You've condemned. You have murdered the just. He does not resist you. This may mean, I think, the power that they have to take advantage of other people, perhaps through the law system, the courts, getting the last penny, getting the last thing out of them. So there's a selfishness here. And James says any of us who might get that have to watch out for that selfishness. And they persecuted them. All right, they took them to court, and maybe they controlled the courts. Wealth may become a means of political power. Will it become a means of spiritual power in your local church? Watch out. However, we look at this, whatever the Lord gives us is a lot in life, let's think this thing through about wealth. Because right here, as I said, it was clothes and hoarding. So they had clothes and they had land and they were saving. But they weren't thinking of other people. The people who served them were not getting anything back. And many, many times the Old Testament warned about judges. Exodus 18:21 says the judges were not to be greedy. They were not to judge this way. Leviticus 19:15, they were not to be partial to the rich. Hey, are we partial to the rich in our assemblies? Are we a partial to the rich in our churches? Thinking maybe in the organization is something that guy can write out a big check. It wasn't many, many years ago when somebody who was quite wealthy who fell out of sorts with the church he was going to told me he wasn't going to give to the church. And this is true. And he said it was going to go out of business in 6 months. He was wrong. See? And I told him so. It'll be tight, but they'll be around. He's going to go out in 6 months. Wow. Because he fell out of sorts. And there were some things he didn't like. And so perhaps it was going to happen. So the poor here are taken advantage of. And these people have used the system. I suppose a good way, a good biblical illustration of this is 1 Kings 21:7-14, Ahab and Naboth's vineyard. A good example of using the legal system to get something you want. So James tells these people they are to watch out. And enough warning on that. I wanted to go over that quickly. But now I want to start at verse 7 and finish this chapter up. There's some vital things here. And these things, warnings about material things, are things that we can greatly understand and let the Lord help us with and encourage us. Now verse 7, therefore be patient. Now, therefore, when I went to Bible school, one of the teachers said something that I've never forgotten. When you get to the word therefore, that's what it's there for. You've heard that before, but that's stuck in my brain, see. Well, therefore, going back to what he just said, perhaps of injustice, or the fact that we don't all have the same thing. There's weariness in the world. There are hard times. There's difficulty. Therefore, I want you to do something, brethren. Be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. There may be injustices. There may be things that have hurt us. There is tribulation in this world. And this is what you want. Be patient. Be long in suffering. Be patient at this thing. And then in verse 11, he'll talk about endure, to remain under, be long-suffering and remain under. Carry the burden. And endurance under great stress. Somebody put it this way. James is saying, stay put and stand fast when you would like to run away. Stay put, stand fast when you would like to run away. Now, obviously, there are certain situations we should run away from. But James is saying this. Be patient. A long suffering, this endurance, the temper that does not easily succumb under suffering. So James is bringing the subject of suffering up. And he's going to use some examples, all right? He asks us to be patient. He asks us to endure. He says in verse 9, don't grumble against one another. James brings up relationships with people all the time in this book. Isn't it funny how trials lead us to murmur against God, and how riches lead us to murmur against people, and worldly attitudes lead us to murmur against people? Isn't it interesting? Our spiritual attitude, if not right, always, in some way or the other, we end up attacking people. So keep patient. Don't doubt. Don't murmur. Don't grumble against one another. Lest you condemn, behold, the judge is standing at the door. So keep patient. Don't murmur. Our relationships with one another are important. But now he's going to use three examples, and they're simple examples. The first one is a farmer, a good example of waiting. Verse 7, see the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth. I like that, the precious fruit. James talks about patience, the seed planted in us, listening to the word, bringing forth righteousness in our lives. The farmer tills and he plows and he plants and he cares for it, but there's something he can't do. I go to a place up in northern Wisconsin where most of them are farmers, and we were talking about this just a couple weeks ago because I asked one farmer how it was going. Before we got a lot of rain, and I haven't been able to do much on certain crops. He said, so I'm looking out the back door every day. I thought of this right away. Say, well, I'm just waiting, looking out the back door every day. What's the day going to be like? When is this going to dry up? So the farmer plants, and he does this, and he waits, and he's patient. This is the point about the seed that's planted in life, the growth in spiritual life, patience, the growth in suffering, patience, endurance. This is the theme of chapter 1. And James picks it up here again. So we have to wait. And there are certain things we can't do. But we wait patiently until he receives the early and the latter rain. These rains that would come in the beginning and help it grow. And then the latter rain when a rich harvest would come. So James talks about the farmer waiting for the precious fruit. He may be anxious for it to come. Like Randy is up in Castle, going to the back door and looking out the back door, anxious for the weather to clear up. But he can't do much about it. He waits on the Lord, and he waits patiently. And he waits for that valuable, precious crop. You want to know the Word of God? Study it. You want to live a righteous life? Put some discipline into it. You want God to bless you, and blessed is the man, he says in chapter 1, who endures. Endure. Walk. Trust. And there will be a precious fruit. And so the farmer, to get this precious fruit that is so important, the farmer has to wait. And the farmer has to patiently wait for the spiritual harvest, the seed planted in our lives. And then he goes on. Not only is he waiting, but he talks about the prophets. Verse 10. My beloved, my brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Well, here's another one. Now, these people are workers and sufferers. The farmer is somebody who plants and waits. You study the word, but you wait for the harvest. You spend some time in prayer and you wait for the harvest. You take some discipline and it takes years to grow. But now these people are the workers and sufferers. And I'm always amazed by the prophets. What they were asked to do, and the little hope they had, for goodness sake. I mean, some of these guys' ministries ended up in disaster. See? They preached and they ranted and raved, and their lives ended up in disaster. They just didn't get any place in this thing. And a whole lot of things didn't happen other than warning people. But here then are the prophets, their workers. All right? There are people who've gone before, the Old Testament example. The Old Testament prophets, the examples of Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, David did this. By faith, Abraham did that. By faith, somebody did that. By faith, somebody did that. But then I like to change. By faith, they were sawn asunder. And by faith, their life ended up in a disaster. And they were all workers, living by faith. And some people's life ended up in disaster. They died. They were sawn in skins. They were killed. They died of the sword. So, James has these people on his mind. What's important about these people is these prophets, as he talks, my brethren, the prophets who spoke the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience, is that they did the will of God and suffered. They did the will of God and had difficulties. Doing the will of God may mean that. Satan says we suffer because of sin or unfaithfulness. And we may suffer more for faithfulness than unfaithfulness. And so, James is talking about this again, the prophets. We count them blessed who endure. Doesn't that sound like chapter 1 again? Blessed is the man who endures. And he picks up the theme in the end of the book. So, we think of these people. Not all of our suffering is because we've done something wrong. People who do righteousness often suffer. And James is talking. They were handled unjustly by the system. Maybe that's one of the things he wants to say in verses 1 to 6. He might be talking about the unsaved world and their methods of living and their methods of treating people and what they're going to do and the unjustness of lawsuits and taking advantage and not paying a proper wage. He said, but I want you to be patient and hope in the coming of the Lord. Just as a farmer waits for the precious fruit. But think of also the prophets, he says, the prophets and how they suffer. And Jeremiah being put in the well and Ezekiel being carried away. Now another case of suffering, verse 11. And that next case of suffering in verse 11 is, of course, Job. And the theme is suffering. Indeed, we count them blessed to endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. The patience of Job, when you read Job, you don't see much patience. Not really. When I read Job, I see impatience. I see some resentment. I see struggles. I see questions. I see some feeling of injustice. And then his friends come, and his friends are in help. They're these self-styled counselors, these self-styled people. They've read one self-help book from the local Christian bookstore, and they have the answers. And they come in, and they've got all of their theories. The point I want to make is simply this. Behind our suffering is something we may not understand, and God is a goal we can't understand. And we know the end intended. We know it because we read it. Fortunately, God, in the first chapter, pulled back the curtain and said, well, I'll tell you the end of the story now. See? I'll tell you what's really going on. But there is an intended end. And Job didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. He didn't know what was going on between God and Satan. He was impatient, but he endured. And he often was impatient. And you can read these various things of Job. He was a righteous man, yet he suffered. God had higher purposes in his suffering than just the punishment of sin. But to bring us into contact with him. Give us a greater sense of his strength and his power. Give us a greater strength of being able to work in our lives and through our lives. And so it's important to understand that. So, you have the illustration of Job, and we've seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or even under oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, lest you fall into judgment. Interesting verse, oaths. How does this fit in? Maybe I can describe this for you, but I'll see what I can do, but maybe it's making bargains with God. Swear, I'll do this, Lord, you know. You do this for me and I'll serve you. Well, you know how people say, hey, swear to God. Swear to God, it's the truth. And people so quickly bring God into their dealings and they have no intentions of having God in their dealings. Say, no, before God, boy, say, swear to God, it's a fact. Lord, I promise. Maybe that's what he's talking about. Bringing God into all of these things and kind of attaching them onto it as some new form of blessing. And it would be better if we did. Using the name of God to bind something. And once God's name is used, remember, he becomes an active partner in the transition. And that's almost what we tell people in premarital counseling. You want to be married in the church and God bless him. Okay, he becomes an active partner in this transition. He's active in this thing. So anyway, these oaths became kind of a commonplace. When they were repeated so much, they became meaningless. And in an honest society, you don't need it. Hey, I swear to God, I'll pay you. See? In an honest society, you don't need it, see? When you're dealing with trustworthy people. And maybe these then were swearing by different oaths and matters and bringing God into this matter and attaching him to it and asking for his blessing. One more thing because I want to get through this. This is to me the thing I really want to do this morning. James has talked here about the reliance on certain things. Now let's go to this last portion. Take a few minutes and then we'll quit. This last portion of James is difficult. I think most of us have read it and felt we were guilty. There are many of us, I suppose, who become kind of reluctant advocates of a healing ministry in the church. And there seems to be general agreement in verses 13 and on, general agreement that it deals with physical sickness among God's people. The debate is usually how it's done. We go in and we anoint with oil and the people confess their sins. Maybe I shouldn't have made a handout for it, but people confess their sins, and maybe there's some kind of a formula for healing people. And often when this is done, then people feel, well, we've missed it. We didn't pray right. Or the elders didn't have faith. I remember we as elders in Columbia, people asked us to do this, and then we did this. And the people weren't healed, and they thought that the elders didn't pray right. Many see a formula for church practice which obligates God to honor their request. A number of years ago, a woman called Wauwatosa. The neighbor wanted to talk, so the elder said, John, go talk to him. So she came and we talked. A woman in her mid-30s. Her husband had run out on her a couple of years before, so she was struggling to care for her kids. She was struggling to take care of her kids. And at the same time, she found out she was a diabetic. So she met some of her well-meaning friends who went to a church where they believed in healing. And she sees these well-meaning friends, and they said, if you pray in faith and have the leaders come, you'll be healed. So the leaders came and they prayed, and they prayed over her, and she wasn't healed. And then she went through the agony, I don't have enough faith. Well, maybe the leaders don't have faith. So why she came to talk to us at Wauwatosa, I'll never know. I think somebody recommended she did it. Come and talk. So she came to talk, and during the process, she asked if we could anoint her and pray over her, and she would be healed. And to make a long story short, I told her, you know, maybe God wants you to live with this. And she couldn't handle that. And I said, you know, I think we ought to do right now. And I don't know if I did the right thing. I tend to think I did. But I said, what I'd like you to do right now is close your eyes and pray with me and thank God for insulin. She really gave me a long look. She said, I can't do that. Insulin is medicine. That's not healing. I said, without her, how long would you live? Why don't we just thank God for this? I can't do that, she said. I want to be healed. I said, well, I can't offer that to you. I can't guarantee that. But you see, the doctor said it's not severe. And if you take this and take some precaution, you live a long time. But if you don't take it, you're going to die. So why don't we thank God for this? She said, I can't. She got up and left. I've never seen her again. Never called back. And I had no idea what happened. But this woman was convinced that this is some kind of a formula here at the end of this book. Let's read this. Anyone among you suffering, let him pray. Is anyone cheerful, let him sing some. That's what I was saying yesterday about Oswald Chambers. If God's giving you a full cup of joy, don't pour it out and say, oh, I can't be joyful. A Christian be miserable. Enjoy it. Sing some. Say, enjoy that cup he's given you if it's sweet and blessed. So if any of you are suffering, let him pray. If anyone is cheerful, let him sing songs. If anyone among you is sick, let him call the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith will save the sick, and the Lord will raise him up. If he has committed sins, he will be forgiven. Now, I would think, and I say this, and I mean this, I would think David would probably be the best guy to teach us this morning because he's been in original languages. But I want to bring some things out to you this morning as a sense of a suggestion. All right. I would like to suggest, as the note written up there, that this portion is not referring to physical sickness only. All right? But rather the giving instructions for the dealing with a person who is discouraged and depressed. Now, I said physical sickness only. And physical sickness obviously concerned with sin, because there is that. But let's look into this a little bit. First of all, what's the context of the book of James? The context of the book of James. From beginning to the end, it's been endurance. Right? From the beginning to the end, it's been going through trials. What is the context of this last chapter? The farmer waits. The prophets suffer. Job suffered. Later on in this chapter, he said, Elijah was a man like nature, like you. He suffered in the midst of a drought, in the midst of evil people. He prayed, and he suffered too. The book almost dried up, and he almost died. The whole context is one of suffering in here for righteousness' sake. But anyway, I'd like to suggest the context of James is important. Going to the argument of the whole book of James. And another thing I'd like to suggest, and obviously I've been helped by many people, is where from Romans to Jude? Is there anything said on this? From the book of Romans to Jude. Paul gave instructions to the Ephesian elders, Acts 20, verse 17 to 36. All kinds of instructions. He didn't say anything about it. I don't know if that means anything. Maybe the argument from silence doesn't mean anything. And in 1 Timothy, the instructions of the elders. In 2 Timothy, the instructions of the elders. And in Titus, from Romans to Jude, there's nothing like it. And the other thing, of course, is why call the elders? Why not call the man who has the healing power? You know, there are people who speak of healing ministries today, and I believe God can heal. But if they really have it, I've suggested this before, if they really have it, if I had it, we have a hospital close, St. Joe's, Catholic Hospital. If I had the gift of healing, I'd start at the top floor. I'd stop at the top floor in the corner and go right down the hall, down this side of the hall. I'd go to the cancer ward. If I had to get the healings, I wouldn't be having campaigns and telling them to come in and then blaming them, well, you didn't have faith. I'd go to the hospital and I'd start right up in the corner. Even if it's Catholic hospital, I'd march right down the hall. And I would make sure everybody was healed. So, there are certain questions I want to ask. Remember, the context of James is maturity through suffering. There's a plea for patience. He speaks of troubles and struggles as a child of God. He speaks of active faith to combat sin, active faith to combat Satan. He speaks of being patient in adversity, verses 7 to 11. And then in verses 19 to 20, there's a reminder of gaining victory over sin. And he uses Elijah. And one of the things I want to say about the end of this chapter, James uses such wonderful, simple illustrations. Every illustration is easy to understand. I want to say this. If he were advocating physical healing only and all the time, then why in the world did he choose this illustration from Elijah's life? Why didn't he pick the illustration when Elijah went and was involved in the healing of the widow's son? Why didn't he pick another illustration? He'd been so clear. Why would he miss the point at the end of the chapter? See? Why would he miss the point? Now, here's where the tricky stuff comes in, and here's where David McLeod might be better able to handle this, and I sincerely mean that also. There are computer programs that have the original language in many books and many ways you can get into it. And years ago, I made a study. I have a little, I'll be real honest, I have a little New Testament. This is going to sound like that. In English, and under every word, there's a number. Oh, geez. And then you go to Strong's Concordance and you find the number, and then you go to Tittle's, or you go to somebody else, and there's all kinds of Greek books, and they all have it coded according to these numbers. And so for simple things like me, you just follow the numbers. You follow the bouncing ball until you get where you're going. And so you look up under this word sick, and you look under one word sick, and it has a number, so you follow the number code, and you get a Tittle's, or you get out to this, this other Greek fellow, like, I don't know how to pronounce his name, so Hydrus, whatever name is. You get all these books, and you read it, and you do a study. Then you take the next word on sick, and you follow, and suddenly something dawns on you. They're not the same word. Huh? They're not the same word. And then it's interesting to see how these words are used. Let me give you an idea. The first word for sick found in verse 14, it means to be without strength. It means to be feeble. It means to be weak. And you can look at this a bit. Be without strength, be feeble. It's used 36 times. And I copied that out of the book. If they're wrong, I'm wrong. It's used 36 times. The point is, most of the time, as this is used, it's used for physical. But it's interesting. In the Gospel and Acts, it's physical 20 times. Same word, physical, God's plan. But in the epistles, it's used 14 times. And almost every time it's used in the epistles, it's used for some spiritual weakness, spiritual struggle, some spiritual weariness. In other words, it's physical, but it definitely is used in a spiritual sense. And the epistles use it 14 times in the context of being spiritually weak. So it is used. So it means to be weak, without strength, feeble. And Paul and the writers in the epistles often use it, and you can look up Romans, I don't have these verses written down here, I should have, but you can look up Romans 4:14 and 8:3 and Romans 14:1 and 1 Corinthians 8, where it talks about all of this spiritual weakness and feebleness. So that's one of the things that struck me as I followed these out and I read this. Wow. Most of it is used for physical, but almost exclusively in the Gospels and Acts. When it gets over to the epistles, there seems to be a change, and the epistle writers seem to feel free to use it also for the weak tendencies in our struggle against sin. So, could it be in 5:14 that James is saying, is any weak among you? Now, I believe it's physical sickness is involved. And I believe that physical sickness can come because of sin. And I believe the leaders can pray for that. But I think there's more here. This is my opinion. Now to verse 15. And I'll get this done quickly. Now in verse 15, the word comes up again. Okay, Peter. And the prayer of faith will save the sick. Now this is another word, and it's used in Hebrews 12:3. Let's go to Hebrews 12. I want to show you something. And I'm being careful here. There's no saying fools rush in where angels fear to tread. And I'm trying to be careful. Fools rush in where wise men never go. And I'm trying to be very careful here. But I want to point something out to suggest to you that maybe we've limited this so much that we don't know how to use it among each other. And the guilt we feel about physical healing may have something to do with this other weariness and our struggle with sin, and it may be something elders need to learn how to do. And I'll tell you this in another minute. So, in verse 15, but anyway, in Hebrews 12:3, the second word for sick, 12:3, consider him endured such hostility against sinners himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. The second word for sick here, 12:3, is weary. And then, in Revelations 2:3, it is used for labored. Labored, it means toil, and it carries the idea of weariness. So in Revelations 2:3, is it possible? Now I'm asking you this. This is again where I'm not going to be dogmatic. Journeymen cannot be dogmatic. I can assure you of that. And I'm a journeyman. But is it possible? Because of the context of James in this chapter, in the book of the prophets and the farmer and Job and Elijah struggling, that he is saying that many Christians struggle with some kind of besetting sin, some kind of weariness of mind, where sin may touch that point of weakness. Now, I've been helped in 1979. There was an article in the Dallas Theological Tortoise, Bipsack. And there's a quote from it, okay? Many Christians have struggled with some form of besetting sin and have known weariness of mind, especially when that sin touches a point of some weakness. Is it possible James refers to people who are spiritually weak and spiritually weary in their struggle against sin? Patience. Isn't that the context? What about Elijah at the end of this chapter? Remember what I said about Elijah? It doesn't say he healed the widow's son. It says Elijah battled with Ahab, and he battled with the times, and it didn't rain. And he went to the brook, and he almost suffered under it. What did he want to do? Remember? I want to die. See? So I would like to suggest that perhaps it has this idea. Now, the word verse in 16, and I rush on here, for heal. All right? And it's used, as far as I can ascertain, 28 times. And in 22 times, it's used for physical healing. I have no problem with that. But it's also used for healing the brokenhearted. It's used in Hebrews chapter 12 again, verse 13, where it says, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Now, we feel in the author of Hebrews is merely talking here about physical problems. He's talking, using the analogy of the body, joints, being infirm, being weak, as something, spiritual weakness, not running the way we ought to, say, not fighting the way we ought to fight, out of joint, kind of not being able to walk, weary. What he says here about being healed, make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated. Strengthen the feeble hands which hang down. He talks about being healed. So where the majority of it deals very obviously with physical healing, there are many times that it's referred to in the New Testament is healed. When Peter says, by his stripes you are healed, do we really believe? Let the four squared believe that there's healing in the atonement. I don't. By his stripes we've been healed. Do we really believe in the atonement? There's this kind of healing. How many people have been discouraged? I remember something that was really bad. When I was in Colombia, there was a Colombian worker. One mission was training people, and this Colombian worker went down to the jungle, and he had a Colombian wife, a lovely, dedicated woman. And while they were down in the jungle, they prayed about, she was going to have birth of their third children, and they prayed about it a bit, and decided, no, we won't go to the city this time. We'll have the child here. Everything is going so well. during childbirth, she died. And Juan Munoz buried his wife. And he went back to the city discouraged. He needed some comfort. What did these people say to him? You know, if you really would have had faith, you wouldn't have died. Juan Munoz started going down, see? And if you really would have had faith, you know, and these people started after him. This man was at the point of suicide. Then he did a stupid thing, and he knew he shouldn't have done it. He went down there, back to the jungle, and he lived way down by the Brazilian border, because I had been close to that, and it's an awful trip. And he stood over a grave, and he prayed that she'd be raised from the dead. People had his mind totally perplexed, and in an emotional state, very distraught with some of these things. That went awful. And those of us who took a different viewpoint had a hard time encouraging him for a period of time. And then when he snapped out of this curse that was put over him, he began to get his head stretched. So, maybe James, I would like to suggest, is talking about this. It's only a suggestion. And believe me, as I said, I'm a journeyman, and I'm going to be very careful about it. Even the use of oils. The use of oils in the scriptures is used for lamps, it's used in medicine, it's used for anointing at feast, it's used on festive occasions. People in health used oil. It was used for their personal care. It wasn't used when they were laid aside. You read in the scriptures that after they came out of sickness, they put the oil on. In fact, the Lord said, when you fast, so people don't think you're in agony, put some oil on, groom yourself up. So I don't go out and think, I've been fasting all night, oh, I'm praying. Make yourself look normal. What are your eyes that bad? Well, I've been praying all night, brother. Yeah. You know, make yourself look right. And the oil isn't always used just for this. When the woman went in and before David and Joab sent her, and he said, make yourself look haggard. Don't anoint yourself with oil. See? So it's used in many ways, festive and grooming. And when they returned to health, the return to health was a sign that use of oil was a sign of return to health. And I'm not saying that elders can't do this, but here I would like to suggest something quick, because we're out of time. I would like to suggest very, very carefully that we're missing the boat. That is my opinion. Because we make this only physical, sometimes people who are struggling will not come to their leaders. And I'm wondering if James is saying here, those of you who are in the depths of struggling and it's wearing you down and you're beginning to doubt and you're beginning to be vulnerable, go to your leaders and pray. Get them together and pray. And have these men pray over you and anoint you with the gladness of victory. Pray. You know, we've seen this happen. We've seen this happen. No big miracles, but we've had people who've been going through things, and we said, come on, and we prayed over him while we're toasting. And we identified ourselves with the struggle, and we said, you come in any time, and we'll get together to pray. And you can see a strengthening factor already in their lives when they walk out. And the next Sunday, they seem to be a little more confident. Now, you come in any time, and we'll pray. And we'll pray for you in this weary battle against the Bible, or this weary battle with you against depression. Or this worried battle with you in whatever it is, the sin or the temptation, will pray with you. I wonder if that's what he's talking about too. The battle makes us weary. It's a suggestion. Remember, I'm a journeyman, and I'm just giving you some ideas, especially when you're a guy who has to go to a number system and cross-reference with strong concordance. And so it's a journeyman stuff. But I discovered these about this word. And I find it very important. So possibly James is saying, and the confession of sin. This confession of sin may be the confession of the tremendous struggle and temptation. You know, elders ought to be very open to people. We ought to invite people in. We ought to tell our people. You know what? Years ago, my wife and I got a phone call. Crazy. About 11 o'clock.